We're going to look at the Bible itself, and the Bible is a historical book. It contains many historical references, but at the same time, the Bible's not a book of mankind's history. It's a book that records some of history, but it's basically designed to tell something that God's intending to do and best the salvation of mankind. But where it does mention historical facts, the Bible has always been proven to be true. There have been many arguments over the years against the Bible, and almost every case, those arguments are based on what is not said, or a lack of supporting evidence that are found in archaeology. It doesn't mean the events and the people didn't exist. The arguments were basically saying, well, the Bible got it wrong because we can't verify it by some other means. Now, the writers of the Bible, both the Old and New Testament, as we look at the various things, they are remarkably accurate in their writings about history. Even though, like I said, it's not a historical book. But when it does mention from something from history, it's when we can verify, it's always right. To a degree that most people that write books don't even come close to reaching, even historians. But it shouldn't be a surprise for you and I, because we understand that the Bible is inspired by God. In 2 Timothy chapter 3, 2 Timothy chapter 3, starting with verse 16, it says, all scripture is inspired by God and profitable for teaching, for reproof, for correction, for training in righteousness, so that the man of God may be adequate, equipped for every good work. So it says it comes from God, and God tells the truth. God's been there when that history occurred. He knows what happened. Then it's not surprising that the Bible's accurate in its records. So what we're going to do tonight is look at some of the evidence, and we're going to look at some things. I picked out some characters from the Bible, things that people in the past have poked fun at. And we're going to start off with Pontius Pilate, because for many years, it's not in recent time, but for a long while, there were people that were arguing and saying, oh, he's just a made-up character. There was no record of a Pontius Pilate. But Pilate is mentioned in all four gospel accounts. He's the one that argued three times that he found no fault in Jesus. Take a look at John 18. John 18, and in verse 38... Pilate said to him, what is truth? And when he had said this, he went out again to the Jews and said to him, I find no guilt in him. And again in chapter 19, verse 4, Pilate again came out and said to them, behold, I am bringing him out to you so that you may know that I find no guilt in him. And again in verse 6, and when the chief priests and the other officials saw him, they cried out, crucify, crucify. Pilate said to them, take him yourselves and crucify him, for I find no guilt in him. Pilate's quite clear that Jesus was without fault. But Pilate, we also find as we read through the story, was more concerned about keeping his rule calm. And so he had Jesus scourged, and then had him crucified as the Jews demanded. Not because Pilate thought he was guilty of anything, but rather because he was trying to placate all the Jews and keep things calm in his rule. Now, historically, there is actually historical evidence for Pilate, because there is a Jewish historian named Josephus, and there's also a Roman historian named Tacitus. Both of them talk about Pilate. Not in great detail, but they mentioned that Pilate existed. In fact, we know that Pilate ruled over Judea from AD 26 to AD 36. Character-wise, Pilate is shown to be a rash and violent man. In fact, in Luke 13, and this is again verified by statements that Josephus had said, but in Luke 13 and verse 1, it says, "Now, on the same occasion, there were some present who would report to him that about the Galileans whose blood Pilate had mixed with their sacrifices." He had killed some Galileans in the temple as they came to worship. Now, we don't know why. We don't know what he was trying to deal with. But he was not thinking much about what Jewish beliefs were. But not only do we have some historical evidence, we actually have some physical archaeological evidence of Pilate. Now, that's a little bit unusual because we usually don't have small characters. And if you think on the world scale of a Roman Empire, a governor of a small province that's called Palestine, off on the one corner of the world, you're not going to find that much. But there is an inscription on a stone. This stone was found in a Roman theater in Caesarea, which is where the Roman government had basically their headquarters for Palestine province. But in 1961, they found a 2x3 rock slab that was used in the construction of the Roman theater. And in this particular slab, it was in the construction of a landing between flights of steps on a tier of seats that are reserved for guests of honor. And on the bottom side of that slab was some writing. And the writing basically reads, this is how you, I can't read Latin, but that's what it is in Latin. I put in square brackets what's missing off of here, because you can see it's been defaced. But here's the letters that are actually there. This is what they think the missing letters are. And so a translation of this is to divine Augustus, this Tiberium, talking about the theater, Pontius Pilate, prefect of Judea, has dedicated this. So it actually has, Pontius Pilate had dedicated a theater to the emperor. But not only that, what's more fascinating, in 1968, and it's just this one just come to light, but in 68 they found a site near Bethlehem, which was Herod's, it was called the Herodian. It was a fortress that was built by King Herod. And following his death in the first century, it became basically a huge burial site. But it was also in the upper parts of this Herodium complex was used by Roman officials who were ruling over Judea at that time. So basically it's the bureaucrat's house. In fact, it's likely that Pilate used the Herodian as a central government administrative headquarters. But in 1968, they found a bunch of stuff, and they gathered them all up, and among them was a ring. And that's what the ring looked like after they cleaned it up a bit. And for a long while, it sat just in a bunch of collections of stuff. And it's just recently that they actually got around to cleaning this ring up, and they used computer modeling so they could actually detect what was on the ring. And what we have is it basically was called a stamping ring. It's what they use to sign documents, to say these are official documents from whoever it was. It has a cup, a wine cup in the center. And on the side, it says Pilatus. In other words, it's basically Pilate in Greek letters. This is the stamping ring the Pilate's government used to sign official documents. And they've had it, like I said, for about 50 years. Just recently they were able to look at it. And so what we have is, you know, this doesn't prove the Bible's right. All it does is say, well, the Bible mentioned Pilate, and people have in the past made fun of, you know, how do you know there was such a person? And the answer is, there's historical evidence of it. They got it right. In Acts, Paul runs into a man named Sergius Paulus. Now, you have to understand that the Roman Empire was a very complex beast due to the style of his organization. It would take over countries and allow the country's government to function under their government. And it depend, titles and stuff like that depend on what the local group had versus which part of the Roman government was running it. It gets very complex. Luke in his records records specific names and titles, which gives historians then a chance to verify his accuracy. And for a long while, there was an argument that Sergius Paulus, that Luke got the title wrong, because it says that he was a proconsul. See, take a look at Acts chapter 13. Acts chapter 13, and starting with verse 4. So being sent out by the Holy Spirit, they went down to Seleucia. From there they sailed to Cyprus. When they reached Salamis, they began to proclaim the word of God in the synagogues of the Jews, and they also had John as their helper. When they had gone through the whole island as far as Paphos, they found a magician, a Jewish false prophet, whose name was Bar-Jesus, who was with the proconsul, Sergius Paulus, a man of intelligence. This man summoned Barnabas and Saul and sought to hear the word of God. Now, for a long while, like I said, it was argued that Luke got the title wrong because Cyprus was an imperial province. And as an imperial province, it would have been ruled by a proprietor, is what the title would have been. But what we lost in history for a long while, until just more recently, was that while Cyprus was under imperial rule in BC 27, Augustus traded with the Senate Cyprus for Dalmatia, and transferred control of Cyprus to the Senate in 22, 5 years after it became a Roman province. And that was kind of lost in history for a little while. As a senatorial province, then it's ruled by a proconsul. Well, it was traded in 22 BC, so it would be a proconsul. Now, what we find is there are coinage now, and if you look up, you know, coins of the Cyprus. There are coins of various proconsuls. This is one of them. I don't know exactly who this particular one is. But it would have Caesar's name on the front. And it has the proconsul's name on the back. And it has the name proconsul on there. And it shows, the coin shows that the proconsul was a proper title. In fact, there's a coin that has the head of Claudius Caesar on one side, and Arimathaeus Proculus, proconsul of the Cyprians, on the other side. And I think this is a drawing of it, if I remember right. Not only that, though, we also found a boundary stone. This one was discovered in Rome in 1887. It's been there for a long while. It records the appointment in AD 47 of the curators of the banks and channels of the River Tiber. One of the curators is listed here, and you can barely see it. There's the L and SERG And then the last name up here is Paulus, is the name of the person, L. Sergius Paulus. Now, whether this is the same Sergius Paulus that was ruling the island of Cyprus or some other Sergius Paulus, but it does show that name was being used. What's also interesting is they found another stone, and this one was found on the north side of Cyprus. It has an inscription on that stone that mentions Claudius Caesar in it, and it also mentions a Quintus Sergius. And so because of that, they wonder if that may be Quintus Sergius Paulus. Again, we don't know if that's the same Sergius Paulus or not, but what it does show is that, you know, Sergius Paulus is not an unusual name. It would be for us today, but in that time, that was a... There's at least two people who had that name, and possibly three if Sergius Paulus that's in the Gospels is a different one. Now, also in the Gospels, in Acts chapter 18, we see mentions of a man named Gallio. Acts 18, and in verse 12. But while Gallio was proconsul of Achaia, the Jews had with one accord rose up against Paul and brought him before him, before the judgment seat, and saying, "This man persuades men to worship God contrary to the law." But when Paul was about to open his mouth, Gallio said to the Jews, "If it were a matter of wrong or a vicious crime, O Jews, it would be reasonable for me to put up with you. But if there were questions about words and names and your own law, look after it yourselves. I'm unwilling to be a judge of these matters." And when he drove them away from the judgment seat, and they took hold of Sosthenes, the leader of the synagogue, and began beating him in front of the judgment seat, but Gallio was not concerned about any of these things. Well, one of the things that was found was a bunch of fragments that have been pasted together in their relative position. These fragments were found in an inscription in 1905. And when they're combined in the proper order, it basically forms a part of a letter that comes from Claudius, Emperor of Rome, to Gallio, the proconsul of Achaia. And with the missing letters supplied for the gaps, it says Tiberius Claudius Caesar Augustus Germanicus Pontifex Maximus of the Tribunician Authority for the 12th time. Boy, say that 12 times. I can't even get it out once. Lucius Junius Gallio, my friend and proconsul of Achaia. And if I remember right, all that's in that section right here. But it actually mentions there was a proconsul of Achaia named Gallio who was a friend of Caesar at that time, which is probably how he got the position. Another one that's interesting is Caiaphas, the high priest. He was the high priest at the time of Jesus' death. He shared the office with his father-in-law, Annas. In 1990, so this is not that long ago. Now, we're not talking a huge number of years here. 12 ossuaries were found. An ossuary is a small box that's used to bury a person's bones. They put the body in a tomb, wait until the flesh decays, gather up the bones, and put it in an ossuary box. And one of these boxes in particular was very ornate, and this is the one that's shown here. Most of them are very plain. I'll show you another one here in just a little bit. But most of them are very... So this shows that this was some wealthy person. Whoever's boxes is, had money to have that fancy of a box. On the side, and you can see it in letters here, and actually there's... this is almost handwritten, scratched into the limestone. But there is also a more printed, formal carving it also on it. It says Caiaphas, and another line says Joseph the son of Caiaphas on that box. Josephus, in his writings, states to us, the Bible just calls him Caiaphas. He never mentions any other name attached to him. But Josephus says that Caiaphas' full name was Joseph, who was called Caiaphas of the high priesthood. So his birth name was actually Joseph. Well, that Josephus mentions that. You don't find it anywhere else. The Bible only says Caiaphas. And then just 25 years ago, they dig up a box that just happens to have the names Caiaphas and Joseph, son of Caiaphas. But not only that, the box contains the bones of six different people, one of whom was about 60 years old when he died. Whether that happens to be Caiaphas' bones, we don't know. But they did reuse these boxes. But there was another ossuary found in 2011. So we're talking about only 7 years ago. And in that box, this one's a little more plain. Okay. But it's Israeli scholars have confirmed the authenticity of a 2,000-year-old burial ossuary bearing the names of the relatives of the high priest of Caiaphas, who is well known to Christians as a rival of Jesus. The ossuary, the stone chest for storing bones, bears an inscription with the name Miriam, the daughter of Yeshua, son of Caiaphas, priest of Mazzeah, from Beit Imri. So this one has the granddaughter of Caiaphas. That was her ossuary. And again, it mentions Caiaphas. It also gives us a little more details. It tells us where his birthplace was. It gives the name of his birthplace and a couple other interesting facts. One is a little more controversial, and this one shows you how plain these boxes can get. This one was very controversial. This one came to light in 2002. It has an inscription on it. It actually was around, I found that while I was digging through it, it's been around for longer. There's pictures of it back, all the way back to in the 1990s. There's some question about where it came from. But it does have the inscription on it, even in the pictures from 1990. But the inscription on it says, James, the son of Joseph, the brother of Jesus. Now, Jesus did have a brother named James. That's the one that was oftentimes mentioned in the Acts as being the head of the church. Now, whether this is the... But the problem that we have here is the names James, Joseph, and Jesus are all common names. So it could be somebody else. But it does seem kind of interesting that you have a James who happens to be the brother of Jesus, who is a son of Joseph. Because most of these boxes, by the way, typically just talk about the lineage. They don't usually talk about side siblings, unless a sibling happens to be famous. Could be. There's been a lot of debate about whether it's authentic or not. The box is 2,000 years old. That they agree on. The question is whether the writings carved on it is actually that old or not. The evidence seems to be leaning towards that it is authentic. But you got some people, especially among the Jewish scholars, who are absolutely adamant, no way. They don't give real good reasons why they say no way, but we know they've got bias against it anyway. Now, like I said, it doesn't mean it's the James of the Bible. But it's just an interesting fact, and at least some archaeological evidence, and shows the names are used, if nothing else. In Acts chapter 19, there's a mention of a name of a man named Erastus. In Acts chapter 19, verse 22, having been sent to Macedonia, two of those who ministered to him, Timothy and Erastus, he himself stayed in Asia for a while. He's also mentioned in Romans chapter 16 and in verse 23, where it says, Gaius, host to me, and the whole church greet you. Erastus, the city treasurer, and that Paul's writing this from Corinth. So Erastus, the city treasurer, greets you, and Quartus, the brother. And then we also have in 2 Timothy chapter 4, and in verse 20, Erastus remained at Corinth, but Trophimus I left sick in Miletus. So Erastus is mentioned several times connected with Paul. Well, there's a piece of stone pavement that you see right here that's been around for a while. I have one with Leon Malden, who was preached a series for us once. He was standing right next to that stone, pointing to it. But that stone pavement says, Erastus, in return for his aedileship, laid the pavement at his own expense. Aedile is a person who's in charge of the finances of a city. And it just so happens, Romans mentions that Erastus was a city treasurer. Again, you got people arguing, well, it's not the same Erastus. But you got in Corinth, somebody who's stone says he's a city treasurer, and he's called Erastus. So unless there was generations of multiple Erastus city treasurers, we have, again, some archaeological backup. In Acts chapter 21 and in verse 28, when Paul is seized at the temple, he says, crying out, men of Israel, come to our aid. This man who preaches to all men everywhere against our people and the law and in this place, and besides, he's even brought Greeks into the temple and has defiled the holy place. And that causes a huge uproar. What's interesting is Josephus also mentions that there was an inscription marked where the Gentiles could go and where they were not allowed. There was a boundary marker. There was a plaque, basically, saying don't go any further. In fact, Josephus said the inscription forbade any foreigner to go in under pain of death. Well, in 1871, this complete tablet was found. And it says, if you translate it, it says, no foreigner is to enter within the balustrade and enclosure around the temple area. Whoever is caught will have himself to blame for his death, which will follow. They had to, so what was recorded in Acts and about the, you know, how sensitive the Jews were about it, they had plaques up saying, don't go here or you die. There was another one found. It's not as complete. This one's whole, actually. But there is another one that was partial. But it has roughly the same saying on it, but it's chopped off on each end. But what's interesting, you can't see from back there, but the letters here, if you look real closely, they're red. They were painted red. So in other words, they painted them so that they would stand out, so you couldn't miss this. So it appears that in the temple there were stones all over the place saying Gentiles are not allowed to pass this point under penalty of death. Again, it's, you know, support, a little bit of supporting evidence for what the scriptures say. Now, you find in the Gospels several descriptions of the Sea of Galilee. And people fishing on the Sea of Galilee. In 1986, there was a drought. And the Sea of Galilee receded and exposed a 27-foot-long fishing boat that has been dated back to the first century. It was found near Magdala. That's the hometown of Mary Magdalene. And so this boat was found on the edge of the Sea of Galilee because they had receded more down than normal. And because it was so deep, it actually been buried in mud, it was somewhat preserved. It even has a raised section on the backside where Jesus, if you remember, was sleeping on the back of the boat. That would be this section back here. The boat's big enough that it would hold about 15 people. Which, you know, Jesus traveling with his 12 disciples, so you can see how they could fit in that fishing boat. Okay, this is not saying this is the boat Jesus was traveling around on. Don't get that idea. But rather to say that, okay, the Bible described a boat, a fishing boat, that people were using. Hey, we found a boat of that style. It matches the description that's in the Bible. Completely. In every aspect of it. Jesus, of course, comes from the town of Nazareth. That's his hometown. There is a monastery, a nunnery, actually, in Nazareth that's built on top of where Nazareth used to be. So it's actually, you know, piled up underneath, and so it's actually now underneath the nunnery, the convent. And down below, we have actually, they started digging out, they found whole houses, basically, the layouts of the houses. They weren't, you know, they're not big rooms if you look at it. They're not, you know, imagine coming in through that doorway. They're not huge homes. But you can see that they're made somewhat out of the stones of the hillsides, plus picking up other stones and patching them together. And it kind of gives us a little bit what the town of Nazareth was actually like, where Jesus lived. It gives us some insights into the type of houses they lived in, which is interesting. All of these, and I know there's just a little collection of this, that, and the other thing, but I've been making this. Alan was asking me where I came up with all this. I said, I just collect these things over the years. And when I get enough of them for a lesson, I throw out the lesson. None of them actually proves the Bible. But what it does is it adds a little bit of confirmation that what the Bible has been saying is true. There is historical, it matches history. Where a lot of these things where people say, oh, that never was, never happened. It's just that they hadn't found it. It's not that it wasn't there. It's not that the Bible got it wrong. And it gives you at least a little bit of confidence that what we're following and what the Bible teaches is actually true. And so I hope you'll find that interesting. It's not a lesson meant to encourage anyone to become a child of God, but we always leave that opportunity if anyone here wants to become a Christian, to follow after what the Scriptures teach. There's no better time than right now to put on Christ. Why don't you come forward as we stand and sing the song we've selected.